because he looks like you're knocking out, but we're always to give us his soul today. I don't know how many people are.
My dear brothers and sisters,
the theme that we're going to look at this evening is the care, the foreknowledge, the preparation, and the control of God in the affairs of in which he deals with mankind and in the bringing about his purpose. In our first address, we look at that care for knowledge, preparation and control in relation to the life of Abraham. And then in our second address, we look at that same control in relation to the life of David. I don't claim that the things that you're going to hear tonight are anything new. Perhaps the relationship between the events that we're going to look at will be new to you, so that we shall have a conception of the control of God, that we may learn to put our trust in him. So let's go back to the beginning of the record of Abraham's life in the 12th chapter of the book of Genesis, to see how, first of all, God told him that he was in control. Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, we all know it well. Now Yahweh had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. God had this land in mind. He knew where it was. He knew what he was going to give Abraham. But Abraham didn't. In the letter to the Hebrews that we read, that he went out not knowing whither he went. And yet he put his trust in God. And God did not let him down. The Almighty was in control. So he came into this land. In verse 6 we read, and Abram passed through the land unto the place of Sichem, unto the plain of Moreh, and the Canaanite was then in the land. And Yahweh appeared unto Abram and said, unto thy seed will I give this land. And there builded he an altar unto Yahweh who appeared unto him. This was the land that was going to be given unto his seed. And then we read verse 8, and he removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west, and Hai on the east, and there he builded an altar unto Yahweh, and called upon the name of Yahweh. As others had before, he put his trust in his God. He builded an altar unto Yahweh. In this place, by Bethel. And if you go to Bethel, you can look to the east, and you can see there's a hill, and then beyond you can see the ruins of Ai in the distance. You can see the place where Abram built his altar. It's got nothing there now, but it's a place of momentous events. It was almost certainly in that situation that Jacob later had his dream and was given his promise that he would inherit the land. And there he called upon the name of Yahweh. And Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south, and there was a famine in the land. And Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous in the land. And the lesson that comes out from the life of Abraham is that when he takes things into his own hands, then things go wrong. It is only when God is the one who decides what happens that the purpose is fulfilled. So Abram goes down into Egypt. And verse 11 says, it came to pass when he was come near to enter into Egypt, that he said unto Sarai his wife, behold now I know that thou art a fair woman to look upon, Therefore it shall come to pass when the Egyptians shall see it, they shall say that this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will save thee alive. Say, I pray thee, that thou art my sister, that it may be well with me for thy sake, and that my soul shall live because of thee. And so Abraham uses this deception to deceive the people of Egypt. It wasn't the only place where it happened. But here we find that he goes down into Egypt. The deception eventually is found out, but because of his connection with Sarai, verse 16 says that Pharaoh entreated Abraham well for her sake, and he had sheep and oxen and he asses and men servants and maid servants and she asses and camels. So he received great temporal blessings because of his connection with Sarah as he goes into Egypt. But amongst those material blessings, amongst the maid servants, was probably Hagar, who we come across later in the life of Abraham. And so this deception is found out, and he is sent back to the land that God had originally sent him to. Verse 3 of the 30th chapter, and he went on in his journeyings from the south even to Bethel, unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai. So he comes back to this place where he had built the altar, having Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And it's here that he comes across another problem. They've got so many flocks and herds, both he and Lot, that they can't live in the same country. And as a result of that, Lot separates from him. We haven't time to follow the life of Lot as he declines from pitching his tent toward Sodom, to dwelling in Sodom, to sitting in the gate of Sodom. But we leave Abraham, who now has separated not only from his country or from his kindred, but also now from his father's house. And it is when this has happened that we read in verse 14, and Yahweh said unto Abraham, after that Lot was separated from him, lift up now thine eyes and look from the place where thou art, northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. And I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall thy seed also be numbered. Arise, walk through the land in the length of it and in the breadth of it, for I will give it unto thee. And Abraham removed his tent and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and built there an altar unto Yahweh. In the beginning of chapter 12 we read that Yahweh said to Abraham, get thee out of thy country and so on, unto a land that I will show thee. And here we've just read, lift up now thine eyes, look at it, northward, southward, eastward, westward. He didn't say look upward, as the churches think. That's not the place where the reward is. It's in the land that Abraham could see. All the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. Walk through it. Have a look at it. This is the land that I am going to give unto you. So Abraham is given further information about the blessings that he is to receive because of his obedience. But still he has no child. He's supposed to have a multitudinous seed. And in chapter 15, that problem is presented to him. Or rather, he goes to Yahweh with his problem. But see how Yahweh introduces himself in this chapter. After these things, the word of Yahweh came unto Abram in a vision, saying, Fear not, Abraham, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. What a comfort it would be to Abraham. Perhaps for a few moments we can follow those two words through the scripture. The shield, the word translated shield, is magan. It's the word used of the Star of David. It's really the shield of David. And in the land of Israel they don't have the Red Cross because they're not, quote, Christians. They have the Magan David Adam, the Red Star of David, the Red Shield of David. So this word Magan is the shield that Yahweh said he was. And in the 47th Psalm we have an occurrence of that word. And the greatness of Yahweh is presented to us. Psalm 47 and verse 7. For God is the King of all the earth. Sing ye praises with understanding. God reigneth over the nations. God sitteth upon the throne of his holiness. Psalm 47 and verse 9. The princes of the people are gathered together, even the people of the God of Abraham. We're connected with the life that we're looking at. For the shields, the meganoth of the earth belong unto God. He is greatly exalted. He is the one that is able to protect his people. If we go on to the 84th Psalm, we see the great power of God to deliver his people, the grounds of their trust in him. Psalm 84 and verse 9. Behold, O God, our shield, and look upon the face of thine anointed, for a day in thy courts is better than a thousand. I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tents of wickedness. For Yahweh Elohim, he who shall be mighty ones, is a sun and shield. Yahweh will give grace and glory. No good thing will he withhold from them that walk uprightly. O Yahweh of hosts, blessed is the man that trusteth in thee. The comfort associated with that title, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. That exceeding great is an interesting expression in the Hebrew. The word for great is gadol, and the word translated exceeding is more and more and more. The idea of further, the Hebrew word is odd. And so it continues on. It is an exceeding great reward that God is to Abraham. He is the reward. The Hebrew word is sakar. It's part of the name Issachar, the higher that Issachar was called. This idea of God rewarding his people is picked up in the second of Chronicles in chapter 15. There we have King Asa being exhorted to be courageous in his service to his God. Second of Chronicles chapter 15. Be ye strong therefore, and let not your hands be weak, for your work shall be rewarded. This word, sakar. Your work shall be rewarded. And just look how it was rewarded. It's not a well-known incident. It's worth considering these incidents because they are examples to us of the way God can give us the things that he has promised. When Asa heard these words,
and the prophecy of Oded the prophet. He took courage and put away all the abominable idols out of all the land of Judah and Benjamin, and out of the cities which he had taken from Mount Ephraim, and renewed the altar of Yahweh that was before the porch of Yahweh. A putting away of the false worship, a restoring of the right worship. Great courage it needed. And he gathered all Judah and Benjamin, and the strangers with them, out of Ephraim and Manasseh and out of Simeon. So not only in the southern kingdom of Judah was this happening, but people were coming to him. As soon as he stuck to the truth, then people came to him. This is an exhortation to us in these days, brothers and sisters. If we are worried as to which way we should go, whether we should hold to the truth, whether we should be forthright, whether we should be positive in relation to the truth, then take this as an example. Because they came out of Ephraim and Manasseh and out of Simeon, the weaker parts of Israel. They saw the value of holding to the truth, of being positive in the truth. And it says they fell to him out of Israel in abundance when they saw that Yahweh his God was with him. So they gathered themselves together at Jerusalem in the third month, in the 15th year of the reign of Asa. And they offered unto Yahweh the same time of the spoil which they had brought, 700 oxen and 7,000 sheep. And they entered into a covenant to seek Yahweh, God of their fathers, with all their heart and with all their soul, that whosoever would not seek Yahweh, God of Israel, should be put to death, whether small or great, whether man or woman. And they swear unto Yahweh with a loud voice and with shouting, with trumpets, with cornets. And all Judah rejoiced at the oath, for they had sworn with all their heart and sought him with their whole desire. And he was found of them. And Yahweh gave them rest round about. I am thy exceeding great reward. If we put our trust in him, brethren and sisters, he is able to give us more than we can ask or think. He is the one that we can trust. A better known quotation in the prophecy of Isaiah in chapter 40. Talking about the Messiah that was to come, the blessings that he would bring with him. Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 10. Behold, the Lord Yahweh will come with strong hand, and his arm shall rule for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his work before him. He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. He shall gather the lambs with his arm, and carry them in his bosom, and shall gently lead those that are with young. A blessing, not only to those that put their trust in him in this generation, because they are the ones that receive the reward at that time, but they have work to do with him in that time, because then he's going to feed the flock of Israel, and not only Israel, because other nations are going to be brought into the covenant. He shall gather the lambs with his arm, carry them in his bosom, and shall gently lead those that are with young. And our reward is to join with the work of the Almighty in bringing the whole world to know of him and of his ways, to show his loving kindness to those that put their trust in him, and of course the severity to those that are against him. The same phrase occurs in the 62nd chapter and at verse 10. Isaiah chapter 62 and starting at verse 10. Go through the gates, prepare the way of the people, cast up the highway, gather out the stones, lift up a standard for the people, Behold, Yahweh hath proclaimed unto the end of the world. Say ye to the daughter of Zion, behold, thy salvation cometh. Behold, his reward is with him, and his work before him. And they shall call them the holy people, the redeemed of Yahweh. And thou shalt be called, sought out, a city not forsaken. I am thy exceeding great reward, God said to Abram. It's a theme that goes through the scriptures. It's a comfort to those that put their trust in him. And that word occurs with a different translation in the prophecy of Zechariah. We go on to the prophecy of Zechariah and chapter 11. There, the word is translated price. Zechariah chapter 11 and verse 12. And I said unto them, if you think good, give me my price, my hire, my reward. If you think good, give me my price, and if not, forbear. So they weighed for my reward 30 pieces of silver. That was the price that was given for the blood of the Master. And yet it brought about the redemption of mankind, the reward for those that put their trust in him. And Yahweh said unto me, cast it unto the potter, a goodly price that I was prized at of them. And I took the 30 pieces of silver and cast them to the potter in the house of Yahweh. He didn't accept this money as their God, because at this time Israel was against him. They were putting to death his son. He didn't accept it in the house of Yahweh. It was given to the potter. They bought the potter's field with it. He accepted it as their potter, the one that was able to work with them, to cast out those that were against him, to break them to shivers. But for those that put their trust in him, he was able to make vessels of honour and glory as the potter. But the word translated price in verse 13 is different from the word translated price in verse 12. There the word price means a precious thing. It is something of great value. And so the work of a reward is associated now with this precious blood of the Master. It's a price above rubies. It's more valuable than any great riches that could be given to us. I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. This God that was able to give the things that he had promised, things that we learn about, and a multitude of things that we know nothing about. The control of God in the affairs of his people. And so we come back to Genesis chapter 15. We're back with Abraham and his problem. Verse 2. And Abraham said, Lord Yahweh, what wilt thou give me, seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is this Eliezer of Damascus? And Abraham said, behold, to me thou hast given no seed, and lo, one born in my house is mine heir. That was his problem. Eliezer was his heir. A servant that was accepted as Abraham's heir. And behold, the word of Yahweh came unto him, saying, this shall not be thine heir, but he that shall come forth out of thine own bowels shall be thine heir. He brought him forth abroad, and he said, look now toward heaven, and tell the stars, if thou be able to number them. And
And he said unto him, so shall thy seed be. And he believed in Yahweh, and he counted it to him for righteousness. No children, but God says, you will have children. And if you look at the stars, your children are going to be as many as those stars. And Abraham believed him. Something apparently impossible as far as the flesh could see. But if he put his trust in God, then he would bring him the reward that he had promised. And so he said unto him, I am Yahweh that brought thee out of Ur of the Chaldees to give thee this land to inherit it. So this blessing is associated with the land that he had promised him at the beginning, to give thee this land to inherit it. And then in the 16th chapter we have the record of another effort according to the flesh to bring to pass the promises that God had made. Verse 2, Sarai said unto Abram, behold now, Yahweh hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid. It may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. And Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar her maid from the Egyptian, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife. And in the chapter she conceives and bears Ishmael. And for 13 years Ishmael was brought up as Abram's heir. And then in the 17th chapter Yahweh intervenes again. 17th chapter and verse 4, as for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations. Neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, father of height, but thy name shall be called Abraham, the father of a multitude. For a father of many nations have I made thee, and I will make thee exceeding fruitful, and will make nations of thee, and kings shall come out of thee, and I will establish my covenant between me and thee, and thy seed after thee in their generations, for an everlasting covenant to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee. I will make thee exceeding fruitful. We've already come across the expression, the exceeding great reward. This is even more intensive. It goes ma'ad and b'ma'ad. It goes on and on and on. It's more intensive than we saw in chapter 15. The expression only occurs in two other places in the Old Testament scriptures. The one is in the fulfillment of that promise in Exodus chapter 1 and verse 7. And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. And the phrase exceeding mighty uses this intensive expression that we saw in chapter 17. And then, in a thoroughly bad sense, the only other occurrence is in the prophecy of Ezekiel in chapter 9. Just look at this, brethren and sisters, and think of the attitude of Yahweh to his people. This people that he had developed by the fulfillment of the promises that he had made to Abraham. Ezekiel chapter 9 and verse 9. Then said he unto me, the iniquity of the house of Israel and Judah is exceeding great, and the land is full of blood, and the city full of perverseness. For they say, Yahweh hath forsaken the earth, and Yahweh seeth not. Just think of this in relation to Abraham. I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward, God had said. Abraham believed in Yahweh, and he counted it to him for righteousness. These people said Yahweh had forsaken the earth. Yahweh seeth not. We shall see something of the way Yahweh sees as we continue in the life of Abraham. The iniquity of the house of Israel and Judah is exceeding great. And it's there that that intensive expression is used. No wonder they were cast out, brothers and sisters. Let us beware of following their example. And the blessing of Abraham in the 17th chapter was that God was to be a God unto Abraham and to his seed after him. This was part of the blessing. I will be their God. And that's part of the blessing of the new covenant that is going to be given to the people of Israel and Judah in the age to come. I will be their God. And they shall be my people. And then in verse 15 of chapter 17, God said unto Abram, as for Sarai, thy wife, thou shalt not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall her name be. Some doubt as to the meaning of Sarai, but there's no problem with Sarah. Princess is the meaning of the word. It's the feminine form of the word Sar, which means a prince, and it's that which is compacted in the middle of the name of Israel. The S and the R in the middle of Israel are the word Sar, which is means a prince with L, and it's often used in connection with a military prince, one who leads the people into battle. In this case, of course, Sarah is not leading the people into battle, but it's the feminine form of that word, Sar, the prince. And I will bless her, verse 16, and give thee a son also of her. And yea, I will bless her. She shall be a mother of nations, kings of people shall be of her. And Abram fell upon his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born unto him that is 100 years old, and shall Sarah that is 90 years old bear? And Abram said unto God, oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. Ishmael had been brought up as the heir, but he was according to the flesh. He was not the one, but verse 19, God said, Sarah thy wife shall bear thee a son indeed. Thou shalt call his name Isaac, which is associated with the laughter that Abram laughed in verse 17. And I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his seed after him. As for Ishmael, I have heard thee. Behold, I have blessed him, and will make him fruitful, and will multiply him exceedingly. 12 princes shall he beget, and I will make him a great nation. So Ishmael was to be made a great nation, but the blessing was to be on Isaac that Sarah would bear. Chapter 18, the message is brought again. We remember the start of the chapter where, by being hospitable, Abram entertained angels unawares. And then in verse 10 of that 18th chapter, he said, I will certainly return unto thee according to the time of life, and lo, Sarah thy wife shall have a son. Notice the words, brothers and sisters, I will certainly return. It was a work of God. It was not the work of man. It was God that strengthened Sarah and Abram on this occasion to bring about the birth of Isaac. I will certainly return unto thee according to the time of life, and lo, Sarah thy wife shall have a son. And Sarah heard it in the tent door which was behind him. So, verse 14 says, is anything too hard for Yahweh? At the time appointed, I will return unto thee according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. God was going to intervene, and the child was to be born. And this incident is picked up in the New Testament. We're given exhortation based on these things, brethren and sisters. We do well to take heed of the record in Genesis. In Romans chapter 9 and verse 9, we read, "For this is the word of promise, at this time will I come, and Sarah shall have a son." The expression is made shorter, and the elements are brought out more clearly. "At this time will I come, and Sarah shall have a son." The right emphasis is made. He was the child of promise. Then back in chapter 4, we enter into the spirit of Abraham and Sarah at this time. And Paul explores the issues that were involved having received this promise. Verse 16 of Romans chapter 4. "Therefore it is of faith, that it might be by grace, to the end the promise might be sure to all the seed, not to that only which is of the law, but of that which is of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. As it is written, I have made thee a father of many nations, before him whom he believed, even God, who quickeneth the dead, and calleth those things which be not as though they were." The power of our God, brethren and sisters, to accomplish his purpose. It's there right the way through the scriptures. Godly men put their trust in him. We too should put our trust in him. Who against hope believed in hope, that he might become the father of many nations, according to that which was spoken, so shall thy seed be. Look at the stars. So shall thy seed be. And being not weak in faith, he considered not his own body now dead when he was about 100 years old, neither yet the deadness of Sarah's womb. He staggered not at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strong in faith, giving glory to God, and being fully persuaded that what he had promised he was able also to perform. And therefore it was imputed to him for righteousness. So he put his trust completely in God, and it was imputed to him for righteousness. Now it is not written for his sake alone that it was imputed to him, but for us also, to whom it shall be imputed, if we believe on him that raised up Jesus our Lord from the dead, who was delivered for our offences and was raised again for our justification. The relevance of the record of Abraham's life for us, brothers and sisters, is that Abraham's faith is an example for every one of us. There should be no doubts, no matter what the appearances may be among the nations. God is in control. He will bring to pass his purpose. And he is still our shield and our exceeding great reward. And so Isaac was born. That child of promise, the one that God had named before he was born. And then we come to Genesis chapter 22. It came to pass, after these things, that God did tempt Abraham, and said unto him, Abraham, and he said, Behold, here I am. That word tempt is a problem. The word is also translated prove in Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 2. We're just looking at the use of that word in that place, because we get more idea, I think, of how God proved, was testing Abraham on this occasion. Thou shalt remember Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 2. Thou shalt remember all the way which Yahweh thy God led thee these 40 years in the wilderness, to humble thee and to prove thee, to know what was in thine heart, whether thou wouldest keep his commandments or no. Just think of this in relation to Abraham. To prove thee, to know what was in thine heart, whether thou wouldest keep his commandments or no. And that word prove is the same word as tempt in chapter 22 and verse 1. And so, back in chapter 22 of Genesis, we read, he said, take now thy son, thine only son, Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. He calls him his only son. The word son isn't there in the original. But he wasn't his only son. He had Ishmael. But this is the only one. The one that was through whom the promises were to be fulfilled. The one whom Abraham loved. And he was told to get to the land of Moriah, and he was to be offered upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. God had a place in mind, just as he had a land in mind when he called Abraham out of the Ur of the Chaldees. Now he had a mountain in mind upon which Isaac was to be offered for a burnt offering. And so we've read the chapter. Abraham rose up early in the morning, a diligent application to the service of God, brethren and sisters. This is something which is an exhortation to each one of us. He didn't lie in bed that morning, even though he had to do the worst thing that he'd ever had to do in his life. He rose early in the morning, saddled his ass, took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and clave the wood for the burnt offering. He knew what he was doing. He still did it, and rose up and went unto the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. Abraham said to his young men, abide ye here with the ass, and I and the lad will go yonder and worship and come again to you. I and the lad will go yonder and worship and come again. He believed that Isaac would come back with him. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, laid it on Isaac his son, and he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and they went both of them together. Isaac spake unto Abraham his father and said, my father. And he said, here am I, my son. And he said, behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham said, my son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. So they went, both of them together. Oh, how prophetic these words are, brothers and sisters. Just think of the heart of Abraham as he's torn between the knowledge that he was going to kill his son and his trust in his God. Because we read that he believed that God was able to bring him back from the dead. They came to the place which God, verse 9, they came to the place which God had told him of. And Abraham built an altar there, laid the wood in order, bound Isaac his son, and laid them on the altar upon the wood. Acting as a priest, laying the wood in order, he binds his son, and he's just about to put him to death. Let's go on now to Hebrews chapter 11 and just see how in that chapter we have a summary of the events of Abraham's life so far. Hebrews chapter 11, there's an extensive section in Hebrews chapter 11 that talks about Abraham. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 9. By faith he sojourned in a land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise,
He looked for a city which hath foundations, whose architect and builder, better translation, is God. Through faith also Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed, and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. She also had faith. Thus therefore sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were persuaded of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And the warning of verse 15 is very powerful, brothers and sisters. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to return. Brethren and sisters, if Abraham had wanted to go back to Ur of the Chaldees, he might have had opportunity to return. Let us be careful with our prayers, with our desires, brethren and sisters. Because if we want anything enough, God may well give it us. It is the kingdom that we need to seek first, and the righteousness that comes from God, rather than things that we imagine in our own minds. To seek first and the righteousness that comes from God, rather than things that we imagine in our own minds, will be a better environment in which to serve him. If Abraham had been mindful to go back to the country where he'd come, he might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is unheavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. By faith Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac. And he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten. Again, that statement that conflicts with the apparent facts, but the attention is placed upon Isaac, the child of promise, of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. And so he accounted that God was able to raise Isaac from the dead. That was why he was confident that he would come back with Isaac to the men that they left behind. And so in the 22nd chapter of Genesis, we have the climax of this event. Genesis chapter 22 and verse 10. Abraham stretched forth his hand and took the knife to slay his son. And the angel of Yahweh called unto him out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here am I. He said, Lay not thine hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him. For now I know that thou fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me. But God already knew that Abraham feared him. Chapter 18 and verse 19 tells us, I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of Yahweh to do justice and judgment, that Yahweh may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him. What is being said here, that Abraham had demonstrated that he feared his God because of his obedience. There is more detail that we could look at here. We've got the ram that was sacrificed in the place of Isaac, in that place. And it's that place that we want to turn our attention to as we continue through this evening. Here was the place where destruction ceased. Lay not thine hand upon the lad. He was just about to be put to death.
and he was, in a figure, received back from the dead. And verse 18 says, in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice. In the letter of James, we're told that the scripture in this event was fulfilled, which said, Abram believed in Yahweh, and it was counted to him for righteousness. That statement was a prophecy that was now fulfilled, in that he had demonstrated his faith and his obedience to God. So God had called Abram out of Ur of the Chaldees to go to a land which I will show thee. He was told to look northward, southward, eastward and westward, and walk through the land. He was then told to take his son and sacrifice him on a mountain that I will tell thee of. And he came to the place which God had told him of, and it was there that the scripture was fulfilled, that it was counted to him for righteousness. There are other things associated with that place that we shall consider in our second part.
Now I look forward to receiving Brother Allen's second address, because you know, stand there going.
So, brothers and sisters, we continue to consider the care, the foreknowledge, the preparation and control of the Almighty in the affairs of his people and in the development of his purpose. Before we go to the chapter that we've looked at, we want to go to the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 12 to see that these things had indeed been considered beforehand. Deuteronomy chapter 12, the commandment for the people of Israel. These are the statutes and judgments which ye shall observe to do in the land which Yahweh, God of thy fathers, hath given thee to possess it all the days that ye live upon the earth. Ye shall utterly destroy all the places wherein the nations which ye shall possess serve their gods, upon the high mountains, upon the hills, and under every green tree. And ye shall overthrow their altars, and break their pillars, and burn their groves with fire. And ye shall hew down the graven images of their gods, and destroy the names of them out of that place. Ye shall not do so unto Yahweh your God. So every place of worship was to be destroyed, and the names of the gods were to be extinguished from the land into which they went. And then, verse 4, ye shall not do so unto Yahweh your God, but unto the place which Yahweh your God shall choose out of all your tribes to put his name there, even unto his habitation shall ye seek, and thither shalt thou come. So Yahweh was going to choose a place in the land of Israel, when they came to inhabit it, to place his name there. Verse 8, ye shall not do after all the things that we do here this day, every man whatsoever is right in his own eyes, for ye are not as yet come into the rest and to the inheritance which Yahweh your God giveth you. But when ye go over Jordan and dwell in the land which Yahweh your God giveth you to inherit, and when he giveth you rest from all your enemies round about, so that ye dwell in safety, then there shall be a place which Yahweh your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there. Thither shall ye bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, your heave offering, the heave offerings of your hand, and all your choice vows which ye vow unto Yahweh. And another aspect of the worship that's foreshadowed here in verse 12 is, ye shall rejoice. It's something that we tend to find lacking in the brotherhood, and particularly those who hold the truth so dear as we do. We need, brothers and sisters, to rejoice before Yahweh our God. It's a happiness of knowing of our reconciliation with our God, of the great things that he has done for us. Let us rejoice in the hope that we have.
and let it show more amongst us, so that the spurious joy that's stirred up amongst the people who worship around us should be shown to, for the sham that it is, and the joy that we have will be a satisfying joy, and one to which those lovers of truth who come into contact with us will want to join us in. Ye shall rejoice before Yahweh your God, ye and your sons, your daughters, your men servants, your maid servants, and the Levite that is within your gates, for as much as he hath no part nor inheritance with you. So there was to be a place where Yahweh would place his name in the land. And we come now to a consideration, a very brief consideration, of the situation of David. David, the life of David and the times of David are important. They typically foreshadow the establishment of the kingdom. The time of David foreshadows the time of the establishment of the kingdom in a time of warfare. And the reign of Solomon foreshadows the kingdom in a time of peace, when the warfare is over and the king Solomon, which means peaceable, it's the names associated with peace, the time of peace comes. So David foreshadows the establishment of the kingdom and the problems that are going to be involved and the warfare involved in the establishment of that kingdom. And so we look then, as I say, very briefly, just take odd verses here and there from the life of David. First of all, going to 2 Samuel chapter 2. We've got Saul and Jonathan have died on Mount Gilboa, and David gives his great lament, beautiful poetry, at the end of the 2 Samuel chapter 1. And then in chapter 2 and verse 1, we read, "And it came to pass after this that David inquired of Yahweh, saying, Shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah? And Yahweh said unto him, Go up. And David said, Whither shall I go up? And he said, Unto Hebron." What was special about Hebron? It was one of the cities of refuge. But I think the importance of Hebron is in the resting place of Abraham. The cave of Machpelah was there, and that's where Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, and Jacob and Leah were buried. It was the centre of the hope of Israel, and a reminder of the promises that God had made to Abraham, and of his faithfulness in bringing his people into the land. But he didn't stay there for all of his reign. In chapter 5 and verse 7, we read that he moved after 7 years. It says, "Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion. The same is the city of David." And this is the first time we read in the scriptures. Amazing, isn't it? The first time that we read of Zion in the scriptures is here. David takes the stronghold of Zion. David said on that day, "Whosoever getteth up to the gutter and smiteth the Jebusites, the lame and the blind that are hated of David's soul, he shall be chief and captain. Wherefore they said, The blind and the lame shall not come into the house." So David dwelt in the fort and called it the city of David. And David built round about from Millo and inward. And David went on and grew great, and Yahweh, God of hosts, was with him. And so in the taking of the city from the Jebusites, God was with him. The purpose was being advanced another stage. Remarkable incident, that getting up the gutter. That's one of the, most of you will probably know that occasionally we go to the land of Israel, and I never thought that I would see that gutter opened up. It was discovered
in the last century by an English army officer called Warren, and his guts all buried in various amounts of debris, and so we never thought we would see it, but in recent years it's been opened up. You can go and see, brethren and sisters, the gutter up which Joab got to take the city of Jebus, as it was then known, so that David could reign from Mount Zion. And so the purpose of God was advanced another stage. In the 7th chapter, we have that glorious covenant that God makes with David, the promise that he makes to him of his seed. Verse 13 says, "He shall build an house for my name." It's this name that continues through the record. "He shall build an house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." Although Solomon wasn't the final fulfillment of this, he was a typical fulfillment in the building of the temple. Of course, the promise finally relates to the Lord Jesus Christ. And in verse 16 we read, "And thine house and thy kingdom shall be established forever before thee, and thy throne shall be established forever." And David's throne now was in Jerusalem. It was over the kingdom of Israel. And so David's house and David's kingdom was to be established forever. The kingdom of Israel was to last forever. And the capital would be Jerusalem. If we look at the parallel record in Chronicles, we won't do it now, but you'll be well aware of the fact, most of you, I'm sure. It says that my house and my kingdom shall be established forever. And so David's house and David's kingdom is shown to be the same as Yahweh's house and Yahweh's kingdom. So the kingdom of Yahweh was to be established forever with Jerusalem as its capital. A glorious foreshadowing of the fulfillment of the purpose of God. So we come now to this curious incident, something that puzzled me for years, in the 2nd of Samuel chapter 24. The chapter starts, "And again the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Israel." The question is, what was the previous time then? Well, I found no definite incident that we can refer to. The margin gives us the suggestion that it's in the 21st chapter. If we go back to the 21st chapter, that may well be the incident that's being referred to. 21st chapter and verse 1. "Then there was a famine in the days of David, 3 years, year after year." Just think of this, brothers and sisters. We aren't used to famines in this country. We've had a fairly dry summer. But in Israel, water is the lifeblood of the people. There's a famine in the days of David, 3 years, year after year. And David recognised that there was something wrong. David inquired of Yahweh, and Yahweh answered, "It is for Saul and for his house of blood, because he slew the Gibeonites." What a reason, brethren and sisters. He slew the Gibeonites. They were one of the nations that we're told in Deuteronomy that they were to slay as they went into the land. But they were different, as verse 2 tells us. "And the king called the Gibeonites and said unto them," now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites, and the children of Israel had sworn unto them. It was because they had deceived the children of Israel, and Yahweh allowed that deception to succeed, I believe because of their faith in the power of their God. It was because they feared the God of Israel that they deceived Israel, and Israel made a covenant with them. So because of their faith, they were given a position amongst the children of Israel,
They were hewers of wood and drawers of water, but nevertheless connected with the hope of Israel. And Saul sought to slay them in his zeal to the children of Israel and Judah. How ironic, brethren and sisters. Saul, in his zeal to the children of Israel and Judah, got hold of this small community of the Gibeonites and sought to slay them. That was an easy job. But when Yahweh, through Samuel, said, look, listen to this. This is very important. Listen to every word that I say and do exactly as I tell you. Go and kill the Amorites, the Amalekites, the men, the women, the children, the animals, everything. Kill them all. And you know what happened. That's the sort of man that Saul was. That's why he was rejected from being king of Israel. And why Yahweh sought a man after his own heart. And so the chapter goes on to show how the vengeance was brought upon the house of Saul, incidentally bringing one or two benefits to David, because Michael had born children to somebody that Saul had given her to after David had gone off. Their children were all slain, so that incident helped David. And then after that incident is over, it says, verse 14, the bones of Saul and Jonathan, his son, buried they in the country of Benjamin, Zelah, in the sepulchre of Kish, his father, and they performed all that the king commanded. And after that, God was entreated for the land. So it seems that this incident may well be the incident that's referred to, that again the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Israel. But be that as it may, we're told that it was kindled against Israel. And if it's against Israel, then Yahweh was an adversary to Israel. He was a Satan to Israel. And the things that we read in this chapter tend to cloud the issue that's mentioned in the first verse. The reason for the incident, or at least one of the reasons for the incident, there's at least one other, one of the reasons for the incident was that Yahweh's anger was kindled against Israel, and it was used as a punishment for the people of Israel, in spite of what David says later in the chapter. We're not told why, but for some reason Yahweh's anger was kindled against Israel, and he moved David against them to say, go, number Israel and Judah. In the 1 Chronicles chapter 21, we have a parallel record. We shall be referring to that from time to time through this evening. It says in verse 1 of 1 Chronicles chapter 21, and Satan stood up against Israel and provoked David to number Israel. Now, Satan is Yahweh. Yahweh is the adversary to Israel. He stood up against Israel. And the word provoked is exactly the same word in the Hebrew as moved in 2 Samuel chapter 24 and verse 1. He provoked David, or moved David against them to say, go number Israel, as it says in 2 Samuel chapter 24. So still back in 2 Samuel 24, we continue with the record. We know what David does. He tells Joab to go and number them. We've read the chapter. Joab takes an awful long time over it. You wonder what the value of these statistics would be after 9 months and 20 days, as it says in verse 8. And there's another incident that follows on that makes the statistics even less of value. But we come on to verse 10. And David's heart smote him after they had numbered the people. And David said unto Yahweh, I have sinned greatly in that I have done. And now I beseech thee, O Yahweh, take away the iniquity of thy servant, for I have done very foolishly. David's heart smote him. He says he has sinned. There's no indication in the chapter exactly what David had done to sin. He'd been moved to number Israel, and that was wrong for some reason. Possibly it was because it wasn't commanded by God. There is also the fact that there is no mention here of the paying of the half shekel that should have been paid on each numbering of the children of Israel. That may also be the reason. But David could have numbered Israel and still have done that right. But whatever the reason, he realised that he had sinned against Yahweh, and he asked Yahweh to take away the iniquity of his servant. And this, brethren and sisters, is the right attitude when we realise that we have done wrong. We go to our God in prayer, we recognise the things that we have done wrong, and we ask for him to take away the iniquity. And it's that recognition that he is the one that is in control, the one that is able to take away our iniquity, that is part of the development of that character that is well pleasing before God. This is the difference between David and Saul. David was a man after God's own heart. He didn't live a perfect life, but when he did wrong, then he acted in a godly manner. He acted after God's own heart. And so verse 13 we read, so God came to David and told him and said unto him, shall 7 years of famine come unto thee in thy land? Interesting, isn't it, that the 21st chapter says that there were 3 years of famine. So he knew what famine was going to be like. Or wilt thou flee 3 months before thine enemies while they pursue thee? Or that there be 3 days pestilence in thy land? Now advise and see what answer I shall return to him that sent me. And David said unto Gad, I am in a great strait. Let us fall now into the hand of Yahweh, for his mercies are great, and let me not fall into the hand of man. You see the attitude of David, brothers and sisters? His mercies are great, he says. This is the God of the Old Testament. The God that the churches say is a severe God. One that wipes people out of hand. The God that is not the God of love. But David recognised he was a God of love. His mercies are indeed great. In the Old Testament as well as the New. There are reasons for the destroying of nations. The nations need to be destroyed if they go away from God's ways, and if righteousness is to be established in the earth. And so David chose the pestilence. He placed himself in the hand of his God. And so verse 15, so Yahweh sent a pestilence upon Israel from the morning even to the time appointed, and there died of the people from Dan even to Beersheba 70,000 men. And that presumably is a round figure. The statistics that Joab had compiled over 9 months and 20 days were all over the shop. They were of no value. Of course, David didn't need the numbers anyway. But the reason why David was provoked to number the children of Israel was that the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Israel, we're told at the beginning of the chapter. And so the judgment came upon the people of Israel. But that's not the only purpose that is fulfilled in this chapter. Because as the judgment came towards Jerusalem, just to the north of the city of Jerusalem, verse 16, and when the angel stretched out his hand upon Jerusalem to destroy it, Yahweh repented him of the evil and said to the angel that destroyed the people, it is enough, stay now thine hand. And the angel of Yahweh was by the threshing place of Araunah the Jebusite, Ornan the Jebusite in Chronicles. And so at that place, the destruction was stopped. At the threshing place of Ornan the Jebusite, the more familiar name that's used in Chronicles. Stay now thine hand. We turn to the first of Chronicles chapter 21 and verse 16. No, I've gone too far. Alright, yes, well, let's say in 1 Chronicles 21, verse 16. That's right, this chapter, verse 16. And David lifted up his eyes and saw the angel of Yahweh stand between the earth and the heaven, having a drawn sword in his hand, stretched out over Jerusalem. Then David and the elders of Israel, who were clothed in sackcloth, fell upon their faces. And David said unto God, is it not I that commanded the people to be numbered? Even I it is that have sinned and have done evil indeed. But as for these sheep, what have they done? Let thine hand, I pray thee, O Yahweh my God, be on me and on my father's house, but not on thy people, that they should be plagued. It's an interesting attitude of David. He recognises his sin. He doesn't realise that the judgment is upon the people of Israel, as we're told in the second of Samuel chapter 24. So verse 18 goes on to say, then the angel of Yahweh commanded Gad to say to David that David should go up and set up an altar unto Yahweh in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. So in that place where the destruction was stayed, an altar was to be built in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. We go back to 2 Samuel chapter 24 and on to verse 21, and David goes to buy this threshing floor. Verse 21 of 2 Samuel 24. And Araunah said, wherefore is my lord the king come to his servant? And David said, to buy the threshing floor of thee, to build an altar unto Yahweh, that the plague may be stayed from the people. And Araunah said unto David, let my lord the king take and offer up what seemeth good to him. Behold, here be oxen for burnt sacrifice, and threshing instruments, and other instruments of oxen for wood. All these things did Araunah as a king give unto the king. Exactly how Araunah came to be a king, a Jebusite, in that place that was just outside the city of that David had captured, is difficult to establish. If anybody has any ideas, I'd be interested to hear. But Araunah had control of these things, and this is what I think is being said here, and he gave them to the king. And Araunah said unto the king, Yahweh thy God accept thee. But, verse 24, and the king said unto Araunah, nay, but I will surely buy it of thee at a price. Neither will I offer burnt offerings unto Yahweh my God of that which hath cost me nothing. And this, brothers and sisters, is a principle that is worth remembering. We should not offer to our God things that have cost us nothing. Because it's no sacrifice, is it? If we've done nothing or paid nothing for it, then it's no offering to Yahweh. And so this is a useful principle for us to remember, that we should put effort into our service to our God, that we should offer to him things that have cost us something. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. The amount I'm not going to go into now. There's a different figure given in Chronicles. But verse 25 says, and David built there an altar unto Yahweh and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. He was a king, but he offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. He was acting again as a priest. Yahweh told him to build an altar, and he offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And I believe that in this place he is there in the position, like Melchizedek, as both king and priest. So Yahweh was entreated for the land, and the plague was stayed from Israel. So it seems that David needed to buy the threshing floor to offer the offerings, and then the plague was stayed. We go to the record in 1 Chronicles 21. We read that after the offerings had been made, at verse 29, he says, "For the tabernacle of Yahweh, which Moses made in the wilderness, and the altar of the burnt offering were at that season in the high place at Gibeon. But David could not go before it to inquire of God, for he was afraid because of the sword of the angel of Yahweh." He couldn't go to be redeemed under the law. Yahweh prevented him from being redeemed under the law. Redemption was impossible under the law. It was according to the commandment of Yahweh, according to his provision, outside the law, that Yahweh received the sacrifices of David. And the reason why I've been talking about this evening is told us in the reading for today in the 2 Chronicles chapter 3. Verse 1. "Then Solomon began to build the house of Yahweh at Jerusalem in Mount Moriah," and that connects us with Abraham, the sacrifice of Isaac, "where Yahweh appeared unto David his father in the place that David had prepared in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite." And so both incidents, I believe, the sacrifice of Isaac, where Yahweh told him of the mountain where the sacrifice was to be made, and the incident relating to the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, they were both preparing the ground for the building of the temple. And that was the place at which destruction ceased. It was in that place that the temple was eventually built. And after the dedication of the temple in chapter 7 of the 2nd of Chronicles, in verse 12, we read confirmation that which had been in the mind of Yahweh, that revealed in the book of Deuteronomy, was indeed being fulfilled in the building of this temple. Verse 12 of the 2nd Chronicles chapter 7. "And Yahweh appeared to Solomon by night and said unto him, I have heard thy prayer and have chosen this place to myself for an house of sacrifice." And at verse 16 says, "For now I have chosen and sanctified this house, that my name may be there for ever, and mine eyes and mine heart shall be there perpetually." The words translated "for ever" are ad olam, to the age, and the words translated "perpetually" are kol hayamim, all the days. It's going to continue on and on. If only the people of Israel had been obedient. But we go on to Jeremiah in chapter 7, and we see that place was not kept forever. Judgment was to be brought upon it. The people thought that they were safe in Jerusalem because that was the place where Yahweh's name was. So Jeremiah has to go and tell them different. Jeremiah chapter 7 and verse 2. "Stand in the gate of Yahweh's house and proclaim there this word and say, Hear the word of Yahweh, all Judah, and that enter in at these gates to worship Yahweh.
Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place. Trust ye not in lying words, saying, the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh are these. They thought the place would never be taken into captivity, because there was the temple. They needed to amend their ways. They needed to listen to the words that were spoken to them. This is important. Verse 8 goes on, behold, ye trust in lying words that cannot profit. Will ye steal, murder, and commit adultery, and swear falsely, and burn incense unto Baal, and walk after other gods whom ye knew not, and come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered to do all these abominations? You cannot worship, brethren and sisters, in false places of worship, in places of false worship, and in the place where the saints are gathered together. It's an evil that's in the brotherhood to the present day. But you cannot, brothers and sisters, worship God and the idols. They thought that they were delivered to do all these abominations. Verse 11, is this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, even I have seen it, saith Yahweh. But go ye now unto my place which was in Shiloh, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it for the wickedness of my people Israel. Look at Shiloh. You can go there. First time I saw Shiloh, there's a heap of ruins on a hillside with a notice saying, this is Shiloh, please preserve the ruins intact. Nobody lived there, just desolate. And that's what they would see in their day. And now, verse 13, because ye have done all these works, saith Yahweh, and I spake unto you, rising up early, again that expression comes, and speaking, but ye heard not, and I called unto you, but ye answered not, therefore will I do unto this house, which is called by my name, wherein ye trust, and unto the place which I gave to you and your fathers, as I have done to Shiloh. And so that house had become a den of robbers, and was going to be destroyed as Shiloh had been destroyed. In the prophecy of Isaiah, in chapter 56, we have the other half of the quotation that Jesus uses when he casts out the money changers out of the temple. Isaiah chapter 56, and here is a comfort that's held out to all those who are not of Israel. Verse 3 of Isaiah chapter 56. Neither let the son of the stranger that hath joined himself to Yahweh speak, saying, Yahweh hath utterly separated me from his people. Neither let the eunuch say, behold, I am a dry tree. For thus saith Yahweh unto the eunuchs that keep my Sabbaths, and choose the things that please me, and take hold of my covenant, even unto them will I give in mine house, and within my walls, a place and a name better than of sons and of daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. Place and a name in the Hebrew is Yad Vashem. And in Jerusalem there is a place called Yad Vashem, which is a memorial to the 6 million Jews that were destroyed in the Nazi era, just before and during the last war. But that's not what this is talking about. This is talking about a place and a name in the kingdom, an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. Also the sons of the strangers, verse 6, that join themselves to Yahweh to serve him, and to love the name of Yahweh, to be his servants, every one that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it, and taketh hold of my covenant, even them will I bring to my holy mountain, and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices shall be accepted upon mine altar, for mine house shall be called an house of prayer for all people, or for all peoples, as the Hebrew says. And so there is to be a house in that place that was prepared by the sacrifice of Isaac and by the sacrifice, by the incident regarding the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. If the site of the temple was prepared so carefully over so many centuries by God, just think of the preparation now that is taking place for the temple that is to be established in Jerusalem, which is going to be a house of prayer for all nations. If we think of the faith of Abraham, who put his trust in his God, the faith of David too, who also put his trust in God, let us realize that the preparation is taking place now. And let us prepare for that time. Let us hold to the ways of righteousness. Let us separate ourselves from the world to the service of our God. Let us not be diverted by the false worship that is around, as the people of Israel were. But when the house of prayer for all nations is established in the earth, in the place where the hand of destruction was stayed, we may have a part and a lot in these things and be able to administer the worship of Yahweh amongst the people of the earth in that glorious age soon to dawn.